Tanaka Corporation or Takata Corporation appellants and the appellees, Sharon Russo et al. For the appellants, we have Mr. Wayne Struble. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And then also Ms. Patricia Myers. All right. And Mr. Struble, you'll be presenting the argument this morning. And for the appellees, we have Mr. Peter King, who's an attorney from Columbus, Indiana. Okay. And let's see. Who will be presenting the argument this morning? All right. Very well. And we also then have Mr. George Nelson, correct? And you'll just be at council table. And council, I don't have your name.
That's
so.
Okay. I'm the younger brother. My name's Kevin.
All right. Very good. Okay. That's the hardest part of my job is getting the players all identified. So with that, you may proceed, council, and you have 20 minutes.
And pronouncing all the names correctly.
That's a rarity. Good. Excuse me a minute. I have more work to do. The court would also like to welcome students from Garrettson High School and Law School and also the University of South Dakota. Now, with that done, we would like to hear what you have to say, council.
Thank you, and good morning to all of you. My name is Wayne Struble, and along with Patricia Myers, I represent Takata and TK Holdings on this appeal. This appeal presents three questions for review by the court. On each of the questions, we believe that the circuit court erred as a matter of law. On the last issue, we also believe that there was an abuse of discretion. But quite honestly, the court doesn't have to decide whether there was an abuse of discretion in deciding whether the court correctly concluded that Juror Flynn's comment probably prejudiced the verdict, because on all three of the issues, first, there was an error of law committed, which would require reversal. The first issue is whether information that a juror knows before voir dire and that could have been reasonably ascertained during voir dire constitutes extrinsic information on which you can reverse a verdict under the code in section 1914-7. If the juror then discusses that comment or makes that or reveals that information during jury deliberations. The circuit court said, yes, this was extrinsic information. The circuit court didn't explain why it was extrinsic information. It just concluded that, yes, it was extrinsic information. We respectfully submit to this court that the circuit court's conclusion cannot be reconciled with two opinions authored by then Justice Gilbertson in the mid-1990s, in particular Bland versus Davison County and Euler versus Webb.
Well, doesn't extrinsic information just simply relate to something that came outside the trial?
No. And extrinsic evidence can be something that came from outside of trial, but it does not follow that everything that came from outside of trial is extrinsic evidence. The court made that clear in Buchholz versus State, where the court wrote, you know, very explicitly that just because the jury passes beyond the four corners of the evidence that, you know, submitted from the jury box or the testimony exhibits does not mean that what the jurors say in the jury room is necessarily extrinsic. It can be, but it is not necessarily extrinsic. We count it, we fully expect the jurors will bring in their everyday experiences. They'll talk about what's happened in their lives and the like. That wasn't testimony. That wasn't an exhibit. But that happens, and we know it happens. The question is, what's extrinsic? So the answer to your question is that a comment that relates information that was not introduced to evidence can be extrinsic, but not necessarily. And in fact, Buchholz said that line is very vague. It is unclear. And indeed, this court hasn't drawn that line before. But
here we have information that came from your corporation, right?
It came allegedly.
It
from
came
the
over the internet through a search, and it's information from your own corporation. Who is the defendant in the case?
That is the claim, yes, Your Honor.
So Tell me again why it's not extrinsic here.
It is not extrinsic because in Bland versus Davison County, the court ruled that information that was known by a juror before voir dire, even if known before voir dire and could be reasonably ascertained in voir dire, is not the type of extrinsic information upon which you can then reverse a verdict for juror misconduct. Look at Bland, for example. In that
wasn't
case,
wasn't there a problem here because he wasn't forthcoming in the questioning?
Your Honor, there was no specific question asked of this juror as to whether he had done a Google search or whether he knew anything about other lawsuits against Takata Corporation. There was a question about whether he had heard of Takata, and he didn't answer that question. But the prejudice claimed in this case is not that he knew or he had heard of Takata. That's not the prejudice which the plaintiffs claim. The prejudice that they claim is that he knew something about other lawsuits, and that question was never asked on voir dire.
Of course, the thing is, if nobody volunteered that they had ever heard about this company, there had been no reason for them to follow up with that question. Isn't that the problem that you're into? If the juror isn't forthcoming and honest in their answers, and then you find out later that they really know a lot more than what they fessed up to initially, what's the court to do?
In that circumstances, if the court finds that the juror lied, then the rule followed in other jurisdictions is certainly, then it can be used as information to reverse the verdict and to grant a new trial. But there was no finding in this case that the juror lied. Indeed, the circuit court was very clear in saying, I don't believe that there was any question specifically asked of this juror that called for him to reveal that he conducted this type of search. There's no finding in this record that the juror lied. And again, I think the Bland case is helpful in this point.
You rely on the Bland case, but the Schamburger case says that possession of knowledge not obtained through the introduction of evidence, but acquired prior to trial, and gives examples of experiments, investigations, news media, etc., are all extrinsic evidence. Relying on Weinstein, and so how do you square that?
All of those, Your Honor, are examples of information that came to the jurors after they had been impaneled, after they were already jurors. The publicity talked about in Weinstein is publicity that a juror hears after he's already on the case. The experiments are experiments that the jurors conduct in the jury room that, again, are after voir dire when there isn't a reasonable opportunity to find out whether there's some actual prejudice here. And the example of information that is discussed but was not introduced in the evidence, if you look at those cases in Weinstein, those are all cases where the information came to the juror after he had already been impaneled. It was sometime during the course of trial or sometime during jury deliberations. You will not find any cases where the court viewed it as grounds for reversal when the information was known to the juror before he was impaneled and reasonable voir dire could have ascertained that information. The same thing happened in Bland. In that case, one of the juror comments over which there was complaint was that the jurors had discussed what was the appropriate speed to drive on icy conditions through what was called Loomis Curve. And Justice Gilbertson noted properly that the jury had been asked, have you driven in icy conditions? And it had been asked, well, do you know, are you familiar with this accident site? Kind of asked questions around either side of it, but never directly asked, have you ever driven through icy conditions, or do you have any views on whether they're, how fast you drive in icy conditions during this curve? And I think the thrust of what the opinion was saying is that during voir dire, and this goes to your question, that during voir dire, there's a responsibility as well as a right. Counsel are given a very precious right to ferret out actual prejudice on the part of jurors during voir dire. That's a gift. But with it comes the responsibility to ask the questions that go to the heart of what might be a prejudice that they foresee in a case. And it's unfair then, after, in this case, a three-week trial, or after the trial court expends all of its resources and time in a trial, for a party who didn't ask those questions and those specific questions and make use of that gift, to come back and want another bite at the apple.
But in this case, it's not really prejudice. It's more information that was gathered other than in the courtroom. I mean, it isn't the prejudice. Obviously, I think, you know, you're absolutely right on the prejudice part of it. I mean, it is the lawyer's responsibility to ferret that out at the beginning. But if it's information, that's a different issue as far as I can see.
But information is inconsequential if it doesn't prejudice something. If it doesn't influence a juror, if it doesn't impact the outcome, then it really doesn't matter whether a juror knows something or doesn't know something.
But didn't the trial court determine that it did, that it had that... there was the possibility that it had.
Which now goes to the third issue. And I'd suggest as a matter of law, Your Honor, that conclusion was erroneous. The court instructed the jury that it could not consider evidence of other lawsuits on the question of whether the product was defective. And under the Bland case and also under the Buchholz case, a jury will be presumed to have followed or eventually followed the court's instructions, even when there's some extrinsic information that comes before or comes into the jury room. Well, because the jury is presumed to follow the court's instructions, and because this court told the jury that it should not consider the evidence, any evidence of other lawsuits as evidence of a defect, then the court could not conclude that the evidence of other lawsuits probably did affect. It had instructed the jury not to consider it. The jury was presumed to follow that instruction. Therefore, it could not reach the opposite conclusion, which was that the jury did not follow that instruction.
You know, but that argument would require a ruling in your favor. Say the jury had been told improperly about insurance, something that nobody would argue. That would be prejudicial. Yet your argument would say that it's not prejudicial because it's not relevant. And we certainly can't. That's not the rule anyplace. Insurance information is basically always available for retrial.
Yes, it is. And courts step. But in this type of situation, we don't have any party who crossed the line against a known rule of law and said, here, and talked about insurance information when they knew they shouldn't. What we have here instead is a situation...
Well, we had that happen, though, in the case, I can't remember the name of, in Marshall County, where the state trooper gives the juror the ride and says, this is just a case about insurance. And don't fault the counsel, but we had to send it back because of the taint of the mention of the insurance that got into the jury room.
Yes, and exactly, because that was information that got to the jury after voir dire, after there was, you know, deliberations were underway. It was not information that could have been ascertained before the jury even raised his right hand, before he became a member of the jury. It was not information that could have been explored on voir dire.
Is your argument weakened by the fact that the trial court found this particular juror not to be credible?
The court did not find the juror's explanation to be credible on how extensively he searched. But on the facts that matter to this appeal, there was no finding that the juror was incredible. For example, the facts that matter are that this information was garnered by the juror, whatever it was, and however much he searched on the Internet. This information was garnered before he was impaneled. That's the key fact, and there's absolutely no credibility finding to the contrary. And indeed, that's the finding of the court on appellant's appendix page 62, that this all happened prior to voir dire. So That finding does not matter. There's another finding. Well, I'll set that aside for a later issue. So, the point is, how do we square this case, this ruling by the court, with the pronouncement in Bland that information known to the jury or known to a juror, which then the juror then relates in the jury room, should have been explored in voir dire? I think the cases are irreconcilable. And this is what, Your Honor, we go to another secondary source, you know, Wright and Gold, formerly Wright and Miller, say has been the approach adopted by different courts. It's very difficult to say when is something extrinsic and therefore worthy of reversing a trial verdict and when is it not. But there is a bright line test that many jurisdictions have developed. And those jurisdictions have said that for sure, if this is information that could have been reasonably ascertained in voir dire, then it does not rise to the level of stuff that should cause us to reverse a verdict. And instead, it's got to be something that the jury learned afterwards for it to be extrinsic information, or you have to find that a juror outright lied. And here, Your Honor, going back to your question about the lie or the potential for a lie, number one, the court didn't find that there was a lie. But number two, we have the United States Supreme Court decision in the McDonough Power case, which the Eighth Circuit also echoed in the Taylor case, in which it says that in that instance, where the claim is that the juror didn't fess up in voir dire and that he lied, you've got to find three things. First of all, you've got to find that the answer was outright dishonest, just not inaccurate, failing of memory or anything of that sort, but it was inaccurate. Second, it was motivated by a bias. In other words, this juror gave the wrong answer. This juror lied because he was motivated by partiality for a particular party. And third, then, you've got to find that the answer, if true, would have been enough to strike the juror for cause. None of that is present in this case on this record. So even if we're troubled by the fact, as we could be troubled, that the juror didn't acknowledge that he had heard of Takata, even though that was not really the question that mattered. The question was whether he had done any sort of search that would have given him any sort of information, whether he knew anything about other lawsuits. But even if we're troubled by that answer, there is no finding that it was motivated out of some bias, or even that a truthful answer that he had heard of Takata would have been enough for a peremptory challenge, to strike him for cause. So even if that's the angle or the avenue that the court wants to follow, the case would require reversal because there aren't findings that would enable us to say that there should be a new trial based on the fact that the juror lied during voir dire. But this, if you look at the cases in South Dakota, virtually all of the cases deal with extrinsic information where the juror learned new information and communicated it to the jury after he was already a juror, when there was no opportunity to do anything about it. And in the two cases, the only two cases where the information was learned by the juror before the trial started and before the person was even a juror, Land and Euler, the court viewed it as in essence intrinsic to the juror's background. And Euler, of course, was the medical malpractice case where a juror related in the jury room that the hospital had previously settled in the case. Well, that was a fact which was known to the jury, known before voir dire even started, but neither party asked about it.
2 minutes.
And the court therefore concluded that it was intrinsic. It was Justice Gilbertson, or then Justice Gilbertson's exact word, it was intrinsic because it could have been discovered during voir dire, and we're not going to grant retrials based on stuff that could have been discovered during voir dire.
I'd like to ask a little bit about
what happened in the jury room, because it seems to me that there was an attempt to self-correct. Once this offending juror brought up this information, another juror said, hey, that's improper, and the discussion stopped. How should we be viewing that?
I think you should be viewing that in two ways, Your Honor. First of all, take solace in the fact that the substance of the comment wasn't even discussed, just its propriety. Even among these four or five jurors who heard the comment, they didn't go on to discuss the meaning of the other lawsuits and how that should affect their verdict. They only discussed whether it was proper for this juror to have done the search in the first place. So I think that's important. The second thing that's important is that the jury as a whole didn't discuss it. We were able, in the time available, to get testimony in the form of affidavits or testimony from 10 of the 12 jurors. Well, of the 10, not one of them claimed that the jury discussed the substance of the comment related by Juror Flynn. In fact, two of them didn't even know that it had been made. And 8 affirmatively declared, hey, we didn't discuss this. And the other two jurors, which were, you know, obtained affidavits by the plaintiffs, they didn't claim that the jury discussed it. That, Your Honor, goes to why I believe that the court, the circuit court, abused its discretion. It says that somehow we should have a new trial because the comment was made during a crucial stage of the deliberations, but the evidence all is that the jury wasn't even deliberating at that point. It was having in little splinter groups, having, you know, multiple conversations.
Your time has expired. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. King, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, may it please the court and counsel for the appellant, I stand here today to defend a well-reasoned and factually very specific finding of a grant of a new trial that occurred as a result of the insertion of extrinsic information into the jury room that came from the World Wide Web, a virtual library. And that insertion of that information on a critical point was prejudicial, and it was prejudicial to the right to a fair and impartial trial by my clients.
Why is it an extrinsic? Your opponent just spent a good portion of his time telling us it's not.
Well, and I think we should revisit Voir dire, because I think that helps us in that process. So I can set the scene. There was a large courtroom, and we had 22 people in the box. And we spent extensive time talking with those 22 folks. Mr. Flynn, Juror Flynn, was not inside the box at that point. And over a period of time, people left, and Mr. Flynn comes over the rail. And the first thing that I asked him when he came over the rail, and this is in the transcript at 74, I said, now, well, Mr. Sean Flynn, anything have we talked about as you are over there where you wanted to say, quote, I wanted to tell him, that would be me, tell me about it if I ever got the chance. Now, that's a broad question to say, you've heard some things, and is there anything you need to tell me? He says no. The very next question I ask him is, do you know any of the folks here? Now, maybe that's my Hoosier colloquialism, but to me that means, tell me what you know about the parties that are here. And he remains silent. And at that point, his affirmative misconduct of Googling and finding out about Takata begins. He knew he had that information, but he didn't tell us. But better yet, and I do believe voir dire is a collective process. I believe as officers of the court, we have a responsibility to work together as counsel. Well, counsel for the appellant, Mr. Berkey, who's not here today, says, okay, before we got here this morning, had anybody heard of Takata? That's in the transcript at 218. Clearly, Mr. Flynn, Sean Flynn, this rogue juror, is in the box. He says nothing. The third time, he denies. And then fourth, at 237, again by the appellant, Mr. Berkey, is there anything that we haven't asked you about that you think was important for us to know or important for the plaintiff to know about the way you are approaching your job, potentially as a juror in this case, that we haven't talked about already? And then Mr. Berkey says, anything at all? And again, Mr. Flynn remains silent. Now, That's the fourth time he misleads us and the affirmative misconduct plays in. But most importantly, we've heard evidence about there was not a reasonable voir dire conducted on the issue of lawsuits. There was a motion in limine, entered by the court that prevented anyone in the courtroom to talk about lawsuits at that point in time. Because you see, lawsuits were a critical component of the defense of Takata. It went to the issue of proximate cause. Takata wanted to tell this jury that this inertial release, shock loading, partial disengagement of this belt could never happen, and it would never happen in the world. There were lawsuits that said it could happen, and it was a strenuously briefed, discussed the law back and forth, and in the end, the judge let in one lawsuit. And you can see there's a letter ruling from the court, it's Exhibit 2 to her findings of fact entered in October of 07, indicating that essentially there would be one lawsuit, and that was Lori Ballard. And you see, we could not ask about that in voir dire. So our hands are tied behind our back with this rogue juror who affirmatively conducts himself in a way of misconduct because he knows something about Takata that is beyond, by the way, just the homepage. In fact, there's a finding of fact that his demeanor on the issue of his frequency and the depth of his search is not credible. So we think that Bland does apply. We think that Bland represents a work in progress in this court as you start in Schamburger back in 88 and go forward to Bland, dealing with how do we deal with juror misconduct. And Bland really synthesizes all these rulings and does say that if a reasonable voir dire could have determined, then there will be not juror misconduct. In this case, we did everything we could do. We asked the question four times. We collectively, as lawyers, plus we couldn't ask the critical question because of the motion in limine about the lawsuit.
Let me ask you this. Isn't there some responsibility on the lawyer in this day and age to question them about... I mean, you have to assume that the jurors are Googling when they get the names or whatever. I mean, is there some responsibility on the part of the lawyers in preparation and asking those jurors that question?
Undoubtedly, we have an ability to ask questions. But when I ask someone, does anybody know the folks here? I think the reasonable person in this room would believe that, I need to tell you, I don't know Takata personally, but I do. It's kind of like, do I know Cummins Engine Company from my community? Well, I know Cummins Engine because I live there. I learn about it. And by the way, this is not the vein of extrinsic information that is common knowledge walking around. In fact, the findings of fact show us that this fellow Flynn, the rogue juror, had to go to the Internet to find this specialized knowledge about the lawsuits. It wasn't something like, as we discussed in Webb, which might have been known in the community, might have been something that people knew that the hospital had settled out. It's something that just comes to somebody just because they live there. He had to affirmatively take the step to find out. And I maybe don't want to overstate the case, but I believe that was the beginning of his taint as a juror. And I think that Takata, the appellant, wants you to look at this 3 to 5 minute period when he was somewhat like a sleeper. He knew the information in the beginning, and he very quietly kept it to himself, holding it back, we not knowing, the court not knowing what he was doing, until that crucial moment when somebody like Juror Hersey says, hey, this is the first case against Takata. Are we going to be the first jury to do this? And boom, he pounces with the improper information that, frankly, is improper under the court's order, violating the court order, of admonishment, violating the final instruction number 25. But most importantly, it's false. It's false. There are several, if not multiple, lawsuits against Takata. So you talk about the knockout.
Are we creeping into now, though, impeaching the jury's deliberation?
We're not, Justice Meyer Henry, because of this. Because we have identified very clearly and properly that this is extraneous information or extrinsic information. Because, you see, in Bland and also in Wilkins, this court very clearly and properly weighed the appropriate policy decision here, and that is we do not want to invade the jury's determinations, but we must maintain and protect the sanctity of the jury room. Because in our society today, as people look at our system, there is probably one branch of government where there is credibility and belief that things will be done right, and that's in the judiciary. And the crown jewel of American democracy is the jury. And so in Wilkins, you all told us to have great caution to make sure that we protect the jury deliberation process. It is a critical part of the process.
But this bright-line rule that if they knew it before the questioning of the jurors, isn't there some comfort in that, being a bright-line rule, that information, if they knew it before they came in as a juror and you didn't elicit that in a fashion that you could have struck the juror, that beyond that, then whatever they do in the jury room, we don't go to. We don't talk about. I mean, I'm sure that there are, we all know, having been involved in it, there are things they talk about in that jury room that, had we known about it, we probably would have told them they couldn't. But, you know, isn't there some beauty in this bright line rule?
Well, there is beauty in the rule to the extent we protect the intra-jury deliberations. But in this case, this is what Schamburger tells us. We have a verifiable, objective manifestation. It's not like we are on a hunt looking for items. We have found a juror who has admitted to misconduct, who then inserted it into the process. And it was verified not only by himself, but by the way, I think the count is small. There are actually 6 jurors who knew or heard of this internet search. We have.
But your opponent says that as soon as he came up with the fact that he had Googled it, someone else told him that that was improper to do that, and then never reached the merits, never reached the substance of what he had found on the search. What do you say about that?
I say that, number one, I had a juror that was not fair and impartial from the start because he misled and affirmatively lied to us in voir dire and didn't. And every time he heard the court say, do not consider anything beyond the evidence, he knew he had it. Number two, he impacted jury Hersey. Jury Hersey is the guy who asked the question that spawned the response, all right? And so we don't know how that played out in Hersey's mind. We don't need to know, because the rule properly is, once the extrinsic evidence is proven, there is a presumption of prejudice. We don't go beyond or behind that. We then step back and we say, what is this impact of this information on the likely average juror? And quite frankly, we know the answer to that. Takata knows the answer to that. It's prejudicial because they fought so strenuously to keep out the lawsuits from this case. It seemed to me the goose and the gander rule applies. On the other side, to say there are no lawsuits is equally as prejudicial to the plaintiffs at that point in time.
This trial took some 17 days
it did.
To conduct. And then you reach the point where material information doesn't reach the jury, at least according to him. And then you're going to throw that out and start over again?
Well, yes, because as we talked about, as you all talked about in Wilkins, and I think we all firmly believe, that we must have the assurance, as Justice Holmes says, that we do not have jury decisions being determined by the internet, the outside virtual library. We do not have jury decisions determined by outside information, outside disclosures that are not controlled by the rules of evidence. Literally at heart here, and I think the best policy approach for this court is to continue to follow Bland, determine as a bright line rule that, ladies and gentlemen of South Dakota, we are going to make sure that we are not going to insert internet information into the deliberations, because we lose then as judges and as a system the control of the ability to ensure that the substantive law of South Dakota and the evidentiary law of South Dakota is followed. Without this protection, this whole process very well may break down. And it's important that this court, as a matter of policy, here I think is an excellent time. This is not the time to reverse Bland. This is not the time to say there's no rebuttable presumption because, number one, there's no good policy reason to do so. Number two, there's a great policy reason to do so, and that is to make sure that our society understands that we are not going to have this invasion of our jury room. And finally, the facts are so against that process. I mean, if you look at the standard of review here, we look at Judge Kern, and I think all of us understand this, you all more so than I, that the trial court judge, the person who had the opportunity to see the demeanor of the witness, judge the impact of the trial and evidence that went in and went through, would be in the best person possible to make this kind of decision that, yes, this was so fundamental, this was so prejudicial, a new trial is granted. And so,
can I ask you about the, you mentioned something that I wanted to touch on, the presumption of prejudice. And I think the trial court did make the finding that there is a presumption and applied it. You know, as I understand the law, most courts use the presumption of prejudice in this circumstance in the criminal field. Mm-hmm. But the courts are split about whether the presumption of prejudice should apply in a civil action. And I think we may have a case where we actually did apply it without any analysis. But, you know, assuming that there may be good policy reasons why we shouldn't be doing a presumption of prejudice in a civil action, in other words, there should be an actual showing that there is prejudice, what do you have to give us with respect to the actual showing of prejudice here?
Well, in this case, I think also Judge Kern found, even if there was not the application of the rebuttable presumption, she found prejudice. And I think you show what we showed here, that we had a critical piece of information that was false, that went to an issue that was tried to the heart of the case, which was proximate cause and notice. And if you look at the arguments, the final arguments in this case, Takata stood up and, if not once, many times said, we didn't know there was such a problem with this belt. There is nothing that happens like this in the world. This kind of information then, see, what happened was Juror Flynn then impeached and essentially buttressed with improper information that point. But I got off on a tangent. To answer your question about, and I believe it was rebutting the prejudice, or if that's the
right,
proper rule.
Yeah, I maybe expand a little bit and ask
right.
you, what policy reasons, if we're going to examine this, the whole idea of having a presumption of prejudice in these cases, in civil cases, mm-hmm. and as I mentioned, there's a split of authority on that, what policy reasons should we look at to decide whether we want to use the presumption or continue using it?
Well, I think what you said in Wilkins is key. I believe it firmly in my heart that the jury trial process is one of the crown jewels of the American democratic process. And so we don't want to do anything that interrupts that or interferes with that. And if we have a situation where we have extrinsic evidence coming in, and that is, you know, because extrinsic evidence is not good, that tells us as a matter of policy, we've got to make sure that that doesn't happen, because civil folks have a fundamental right, a due process right to a fair and impartial trial. I mean, as I read the briefs earlier in the opening briefs and some of the arguments I heard, it sounded as if that right was left at the door for a civil litigant. I don't believe that's the law in South Dakota, constitutionally or otherwise. And so we need to protect, because we don't say to a civil litigant who walks in the door, hey, by the way, we're going to try your case. It's not going to be quite as on par as we do in a criminal case. There are some things we'll kind of let go by.
But, no. You know, I think that, you know, knowing human beings and having been a judge for 25 years, I often suspect that what's going on in the jury room is a little like sausage making. You know, there's a lot of things that we don't want to really know what they're talking about, you know, because and so it worries me that we give a presumption, because I think what happens in the jury room is that people make irrelevant comments, and then mm-hmm. someone says, no, that has nothing to do with it. Let's get back to what we're supposed to do here. You know, it's a human process. And so if we just presume that there's prejudice without really actually asking the question whether there's prejudice, then I think we're kind of ignoring what human beings do. They do irrelevant things. We ask irrelevant questions sometimes, but hopefully we get back on track. Hopefully we all get back on track, and that's why we have such great faith in the jury system.
Right.
So
and maybe the best way to answer that question is knowing the human frailties of the system. When we have verifiable affirmative misconduct like we have in this case, this judge, Judge Kern, understanding how important that was, thank you, could not look away, because understanding there is the fundamental right to a fair trial.
So what you're saying is the presumption issue goes away because you had actual evidence, whichever side of the fence the presumption lands on.
I say that Judge Kern, yes, clearly found that the presumption applied, as Bland clearly says it should, but even if someone said takes question with Bland, there was presumption, there was prejudice, because she understood after the long battle over lawsuits how critical that information was, and albeit false. That's, there was no way for anyone to cross-examine or test the veracity of the information that literally comes from the World Wide Web from Takata to this juror who says, oh, by the way, there's no lawsuits. And Hersey says, okay, fine, let's move on. If I may, in conclusion, and if I've not answered your question, Mr. Justice Honigkamp, I will continue. We seek, obviously, the affirmance of what we consider to be an thorough review of the evidentiary record that was done by Judge Kern, involving a trial in which she sat, saw, and understood the demeanor, and therefore the right decision here, as a matter of the facts and the law as applying Bland, is to affirm. But there's a larger policy issue here. We bring together today the confluence of the law and advancing technology. And I think this court has the opportunity, as one of the first courts, Supreme Courts in the nation, to make a very bright line rule that says we will not have technology like this interfering with our control of the substantive law of South Dakota and the rules of evidence of South Dakota. Because otherwise, if we lose that control, we will have cases decided literally by jurors twittering, emailing, at lunchtime, who knows when, information coming in from this virtual web library out there, and there'll be no right of cross-examination. There'll be no way to test the veracity of that information. And so, therefore, in the final analysis, we will have a law, not of law, but the law of the Internet. And that will not be a fair and right trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Struble, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I'm not old enough to remember, but they're probably the same pleas that were made when television came on the scene. Woo, we're going to have all of these things going, potentially information potentially coming to juries, and publicity about trials and the like, and we're not going to be able to control what happens in the sausage, you know, making room. And that's why we need a bright line test, which says that if that information is known before voir dire, then that's the time to find it out. There was a remarkable transformation in the plaintiff's position from their briefs until this oral argument. Did you hear them say that Bland does apply? But in their briefs, their position was that anything, not in the sausage-making exercise, anything that was discussed that was not in evidence was extrinsic evidence and therefore grounds for reversal of a verdict. Now they say Bland should apply. That there is stuff that should not be cause for overruling a verdict. And what they say instead, well, this is the exception to Bland because this juror lied. Well, let's talk about the various things he said. Number one, he said we couldn't talk about other lawsuits in voir dire. Our hands were tied behind our back by a motion in limine ruling. That is not true. The court had ruled that it would allow evidence of other lawsuits on the issue of notice of defect. True enough, it hadn't decided which lawsuits would come in, which wouldn't. Ultimately, only one did. But the court had already stated its intention that it would allow that evidence if sufficient foundation was laid. So the hands were not tied behind the back. They could have asked about other lawsuits if that was such a critical issue to them or such a critical issue in this lawsuit. Number two, he says that there were four times in which this juror could have volunteered the information by such broad questions as anything important you should know, anything important do you need to tell me? Well, let me respectfully suggest to you that if that's all a lawyer needs to ask in order to make out juror misconduct, because the juror doesn't affirmatively tell you, then we're going to open the floodgates to juror misconduct appeals. Anybody Any lawyer could ask, well, is there anything I should know, and then come before this court and say, well, shoot, he should have told me that. That was important to me. That's why we have a responsibility in voir dire to ask specific questions. That's why Justice Gilbertson wrote in the Bland case, you know, it wasn't enough that you asked about icy conditions generally. It's not enough that you asked about driving on this roadway generally. If you wanted to know whether somebody had specific information about icy conditions and how you should drive and what was the appropriate speed in this curve, then ask that question. That was your responsibility. And it's not enough just to kind of generally ask and expect a juror to volunteer information. Actually, that's the law. This court hasn't decided that issue directly, but it's the law in other jurisdictions. It's the law in the Eighth Circuit that a juror has no duty to volunteer specific information in response to a very general question. And a very general question about, well, is there anything you need to tell me, is not enough then to invoke the court's good graces for a new trial. Then let's deal with the issue of prejudice. Actually, let's deal with it this way. You asked, if we throw out the presumption, is there still enough to find prejudice? And Judge Kern did find prejudice, even if you throw out the presumption, but here were her reasons. Her reason was, throwing out the presumption, that there was prejudice because the comment occurred at a crucial stage of the jury deliberations. That conclusion is not supported by the record. It's clearly erroneous, but it's clearly logically flawed, if not clearly erroneous. Because every one of those, there's absolutely no evidence in this record that it occurred during the deliberations themselves. It was a comment that was made during a splinter group conversation. Two of the jurors didn't even know it had been made. Six of them affirmatively say, we did not discuss this information.
They were still deliberating, though. I mean, the jury was not, they have not reached a decision. They were still in the process of deliberating.
Well, of course, they had reached the verdict already as to Natasha Pendergrass's claims.
But they hadn't signed the verdict form yet. They could have changed their mind.
Right. But in your case, that was also true. In the Bland case. Excuse me, in the Buchholz case, not in your case. On counts one and two, the jury had already found, convicted the defendant, and therefore the court only considered the extrinsic information as it might have affected count three. So the fact that the verdict wasn't actually signed is not the controlling factor. But the point is, yes, the jury is deliberating in a broad sense, but as was pointed out, we have these tangent conversations, and eventually somebody pulls people back on track and says, okay, let's get to it now. What was the evidence? And there was nothing prejudicial about it, which is the final point, for sure, that I'd like to make in rebuttal. We have this characterization of a juror, what, a rogue juror, a sleeper juror. He waits for the right moment to spring this particular information. There's nothing in the record to support that. That's the speculation on the part of counsel. In fact, what the finding of all that this juror said was, when I was on the web, I didn't see any other lawsuits. If he was really somebody out to influence other jurors based on this information, don't you think he would have said something like, there were no other lawsuits, rather than I just didn't see any? There were no other lawsuits. I looked specifically for other lawsuits. I conducted searches that would have revealed other lawsuits. But he didn't do that. He didn't try to persuade any other jurors based on this information. Instead, when he was called to account by Juror Schock, you know, you shouldn't have done that, he dropped it. That was the universal testimony. It was not discussed. And that's the logical flaw in the circuit court's judgment, that it probably prejudiced the verdict. It doesn't matter if the information was inconsistent. It doesn't matter at what stage it occurred if the jury never discussed it. We apply an objective test. Objectively, how likely is it that any piece of information would prejudice or influence a verdict if the jurors never even bother to discuss it? I mean, if it's really influential, if it's really important, people would discuss it. They didn't. It's a logically flawed conclusion. A sound judicial mind could not reach the conclusion that this probably prejudiced the verdict with or without the presumption. The final thing I want to say is, again, deals with this notion of the lying juror. Because if now if we all agree that Bland applies, and the only question on the first issue is whether the exception to the rule, namely a lying juror, should carry forward in this case, I reiterate that the Supreme Court of the United States, as echoed by the Eighth Circuit, not dealt with by this court, admittedly, but those courts have said that in that situation, you've got to show that the juror was motivated by partiality. And you've got to show that the answer, if truthfully given, would have been enough to exercise, to strike the juror for cause. Not just to ask more questions, not just to exercise a peremptory challenge, but it's got to be enough to strike the juror for cause. Suppose this juror had said, yes, I've heard of Takata. That answer wouldn't have been enough to strike him for cause. And that answer wouldn't have been enough to show that he was motivated by partiality in giving an incorrect answer or an incomplete answer. That is the law. And so what we have here on the first issue, since that's where we concentrated our attention, is now a striking transformation in position from what the plaintiffs said in their briefs, which is that anything not within that doesn't come from the jury witness stand is extrinsic information, to an agreement with Bland that if it's knowledge known to the juror before voir dire, then it should be explored there and it's not cause for a new trial. And the only exception is if the juror happens to lie. And then we have the case law which says, but for that to be enough to reverse, you've got to show that the answer was motivated by partiality and if it was enough to strike the juror for cause. None of that is present in this case. And we can talk all we want about rogue jurors and sleeper jurors and the dangers of the internet, and I agree that twittering and the dangers of the internet do pose a challenge. But the challenge it poses is for lawyers and voir dire to say, you know, we live in a new world. You have Blackberries, you're going to have to put those away. You have an internet, you can't go to it, and I want to know what you've done relative to the pertinent issues in this case with respect to Blackberries or Twitters or anything else. That is the way to handle this issue. Otherwise, you're going to end up with a floodgate of cases coming to this court where somebody somehow gets some piece of information that could have been known before voir dire simply because somebody didn't answer a broad question, anything important that I should know about, you know, you. Anything that you need to tell me. That those are not the types of questions which are the responsibility of a lawyer if he wants to come to a court after a 19-day trial and say, give me a new trial.
Your time has expired, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.